And good morning and welcome to Dad's on the Air for Tuesday, January the 27th, 2009. In the studio with me this morning, we have the author of the Daddy Split Guide and famous from IanPurdy.com, Mr. Ian Purdy.
Good morning, Greg. Good morning, listeners.
And from Dad's in Distress, we have Mr. Phil York.
Good morning, Greg. Good morning, everyone.
Well, we've got an interesting show coming up today. We thought, the Australian government has been making all sorts of announcements about domestic violence lately, they've created this new National Council to Prevent Violence Against Women and Children. We thought it might be timely to rerun an interview that we did with Erin Pitsey back in May 2007. And now Erin Pitsey actually started the very first women's shelter in the Western world, and that was in England way back in the 70s. And she has some very, very interesting thoughts about domestic violence and about the way it is being dealt with by governments and by society. So we will have Erin Pitsey back on for a rerun later in the show. Looking at this week's news, I think I'll start off. A very interesting report has come out. The Australian Institute of Criminology late last year brought out its big annual report on from its National Homicide Monitoring Program. So basically it looks at all the homicides around Australia, and there's a section in that on child homicide, which is obviously the killing of children. Now, the most recent data that was published last year, when they first published it, they said that 7 child homicides involved a mother and 15 involved male family members. So the inference there was that men are much more likely to kill their kids, the usual stuff that we hear. But they've actually recently corrected their report. They say that there was an error in the maths when they published those statistics. They now say that 11 homicides involved a mother and 11 homicides involved male family members. Now, when you break that down even further, only 5 children were killed by their fathers, 11 were killed by their mothers, and another 5 were killed by partners, de facto partners of the mothers. So we have over 75% of child homicides either being killed by mums or stepfathers, or mum's boyfriends, basically, and less than a quarter of them being killed by fathers. So being with your father is actually the safest place in terms of, not being killed, not being a subject of child homicide.
And that slurring the figures was a defamation to fathers everywhere, basically including us as murderers when we're not.
Well, it's really strange the way that these errors keep coming out, and they never they always seem to be inferring that, you know, that men, all men are bastards, all men are violent, and then they sort of, oh, I'm sorry, this error came out. I mean, look, I have no doubt this is an honest error, but it just seems strange that more and more and more of these come out, and when they correct them, it turns out that men aren't as bad as the media portrays them to be. Now, Ian, you've got a story on the tragic John Travolta's son death.
Yes, the death of Jet Travolta. This story actually appeared in last Sunday's Daily Telegraph agenda section. It's written by Jane Hansen. The headline is, "Jet Travolta's Dead, Is Your Child Next? A Star's Tragedy Raised Alarms Over Dangers from Everyday Products." Jane Hansen writes, amongst other things, "Last decade, a Bristol University study looked at 14,000 women who used air fresheners and other aerosols during pregnancy and tracked the health of their infants from birth. The study, Children of the 90s, found that babies who grew up in homes where air fresheners were used daily were 32% more likely to suffer diarrhea. These babies were also more prone to earache and vomiting. Mothers were more likely to suffer headaches, and those using air fresheners daily were more likely to suffer from depression. Air fresheners combined with other aerosol and household products contribute to a complex mixture of chemicals and a build-up of what they call VOCs, or volatile organic compounds, in the home," Dr. Alex Farrow, a report author, said. Also, it goes on to say Krassy Rumchev of Curtin University School of Public Health tracked 220 children from randomly selected Perth households. She compared the home environment of 100 children diagnosed with asthma to that of the remaining 120 children who did not suffer from asthma. She says, we found that the children with asthma were exposed to significantly high levels of volatile organic compounds, or VOCs, when compared to controls. They were also exposed to significantly high levels of benzene and toluene indoors. Ms. Rumchev says cleaning products, cosmetics, perfumes and air fresheners are among the main sources of VOCs. Some products that emit VOCs can be controlled in the home simply by avoiding them. But what about the fumes from carpets, fixtures, furniture, cupboards, gas heating and appliances and the like? UK researchers let rats into an enclosed space with new wall-to-wall carpet. They died.
So there's some really nasty toxins in our homes. Now, there's something really positive. This article suggests there's a way you can actually clear out a lot of these chemicals from your home.
Yes, Professor Margaret Burchett of Sydney University of Technology, her team studied the ability of indoor plants to cleanse the air of these VOCs or VOCs. They found that plants could do this. She said once the plant acclimatizes to the level of VOCs, they will reliably remove all of the toxic gases in the air. Researchers thought plants were cleansing the air, but found microbes in the potting mix did it. Some species whose roots feed the microbes are better at removing VOCs than others, she said. For homes, she says six plants should keep the air perfectly clean. So there is a solution to that, but it's obviously in our chemicalized society, I mean, I think scientists are discovering thousands of new chemicals every day, and they're all tested individually, and of course they are all below a certain level of toxicity, which means that they can be marketed. But it seems to be the combinations of these things, you throw in some air fresheners, the pesticides in food, some antibiotics that might be found in chicken, compare, and also with sort of the air filled with petrol fumes, etc. All of these things contribute and are causing catastrophic health problems.
Well, it's unknown, and we're only just discovering what the problems are, really, aren't we?
Well, we've had all these allergies and these new diseases that have been occurring.
And asthma and all sorts of stuff.
The good thing,
I guess, for parents and for fathers out there is if you've got kids, especially young kids, get a couple of pot plants, I reckon. It may help them avoid developing asthma and all sorts of allergies.
Yeah, that's the good news. It's not just a sad story about all these horrible toxic things. Also, I've read studies before about the fire retardant in all plastics. It breaks down and is passed into the all plastics. This includes televisions, any household appliance. I mean, your car dashboard, anything with plastic in it. The fire retardant in it does break down, and that causes brain damage. That's been proven to cause brain damage. So we are surrounded by potentially toxic things just in our everyday lives. Like you said, the good news is that plants can help.
Makes you want to go and build a wooden hut out in the bush, doesn't
it? Yeah, it does. It really does. It does say a lot for the old caveman. You know, we have this sort of picture that these brutal cavemen living in these terrible situations, with saber-toothed tigers stalking them and all that, they were probably a lot healthier than we are, truth be known.
Yeah, certain. Okay. Now, Phil, I believe you've got a story there on there's been a rise in crime by young women.
Yes, indeed there has, Greg. This comes from the Sydney Morning Herald today from their crime editor. It reads, Ladette's lead upsurge in female crime. The number of women found guilty of crimes has jumped dramatically, partly as a result of alcohol-fueled young Ladettes trying to emulate young males. The number of young women offenders has risen 17% in the past 4 years, compared to just 4.5% for men.
Woo!
So, yeah, it's a huge jump. It says the most significant increase is for traffic offences and in offences against the justice system, which include breaches of bail or bonds and obstructing police. In each of these categories, the number of women convicted in New South Wales jumped about 35% between 2003 and 2007, according to the most recent figures obtained from the Bureau of Crime Statistics and Research.
Wow. Well, the interesting thing about this story, I think, is that they're trying to blame it all on men and saying that these young women are trying to emulate young men and young male culture, which to me seems a little bit strange. What do you think, Ian?
Well, absolutely. I mean, women are, you know, out for empowerment and out for equality, and here they are, you know, causing trouble, and what they blame men, like that they're following men, that the men are setting a bad example. Hey, boys, by being men, we're setting a bad example for girls because girls want to be men or something. I mean, you know, that step in the logic of that particular article leaves me a little bit askance.
Yeah, I think it's much, much more likely that we have a society that, you know, has various pressures and work pressures, and everyone out there wants to relieve their pressures with the beer at the pub, and traditionally it was men who had those pressures, so they were the ones that went for a beer to relax, and now much more women are having those stresses of modern life. They're much more likely to be working long hours in stressed workplaces, so they're going for a beer as well. So it's actually, there's a root cause which is affecting both men and women, and to blame it on men as if men sort of created this idea and are sort of pulling young women into this trap.
Yeah, dragging them into the vortex
absurd.
Of being naughty. Well, and I mean, family breakdown obviously is a contributing factor to all increases in crime rates. The fact that children are not, you know, being parented correctly, they're being brought up in single parent households. All of this is contributing to a lot of the social problems that we're seeing manifesting.
Absolutely. Now, Ian, you've got a story there. Apparently, it's news that teens prefer talking to their peers than talking to their parents. I wouldn't have thought that was news, but there's a story there.
Well, it came in the Sunday Telegraph, yeah, written by Al Halliwell. This comes from a poll commissioned by Girlfriend magazine, so, hey, it's got to be really credible.
I'm sure it's very scientific. Yeah,
really scientific. And also, you know, they only studied teenage girls, so from the heading, which is teens prefer peers to parents, you would imagine that this is teens, you know, which does actually include blokes as well. But anyway, L. Halliwell has written, depression and is the common cold for today's teens, and they rely on friends rather than parents for guidance. A leading psychologist has, yes, he's certainly leading the argument, I think. Dr. Michael Carr Gregg said a survey of 1,200 teenage girls had revealed three quarters were more comfortable discussing their problems with peers, and parents were creating a generation of spiritual and moral anorexics. Well, whoopee.
Spiritual and moral
anorexics. Yeah, well, there you go. But they only studied girls. But apparently it's a problem of all teens. Warning signs, they've got them listed here. Warning signs, moodiness, increased irritability and frustration, spending less time with friends and family, loss of interest in food and exercise, being awake throughout the night. These are signs of depression, apparently, which is, like they said, is the new common cold for today's teenage girls. We should stress there. Although teenage boys, I think, are suffering from a lot of depression as well.
Yeah, it's probably less obvious or less diagnosed than that in girls. There's one last story we'll cover in today's news. This is from today's Herald. Child neglect linked to breastfeeding, which is really interesting. It's not a link that I had thought about in the past, but researchers have found that they analysed about 6,000 Queensland mothers, which is a very large sample, and they found that the longer a woman breastfeeds, the less likely she is to neglect or hurt her child. They found that of the approximately 1,400 women who did not breastfeed their children, 7.2% of those neglected or abused their child in some way. And then women who breastfed for less than 4 months, only 4.8% abused their kids. But if women breastfed for more than 4 months, only 1.6% abused their children. So Very interesting stuff. Yeah, I mean, obviously, it makes sense when you think about it. If you're breastfeeding, maybe you're bonding much more with your child and you're less likely to have feelings of hostility or aggression towards your child. Another
interesting thing about that particular study is the fact that they did study women in terms of abuse on children. Normally, all of the abuse is basically lumped on men. And the fact that they've acknowledged that women are likely to abuse children, and they're looking at the causes of it. And this, I agree with you, something in the bonding between mother and child. Obviously, you know, you can't get much closer, I would imagine, never having breastfed anybody, although I was breastfed. You can sort of see how there is a link.
And you'd imagine that, going back to that first story of today, those mothers that do end up killing their children, you know, in the last year there was 11 of those. You can't help but imagine they probably didn't have this strong bonding with their children. So
it'd be interesting to know how homicides are linked with breastfeeding or not. That would be an interesting. Could no doubt glean that from the statistics and few interviews.
The interesting thing is they've actually stopped publishing a gender breakdown for child abuse. The last time they did that was, I think, 12 or 14 years ago, because the statistics were showing that mums were much more likely to abuse their children. They've actually stopped publishing that data for decades. But obviously that data is still available for studies like this. They just don't make it public to the general public. So interesting stuff.
Very interesting.
Anyway, we'll be back with more after this break.
Get a job!
What for?
I'm trying to think.
Talk a mile a minute.
We're back with Dad on the Air.
And welcome back to Dad's on the Air. Now, in May 2007, the Dad's on the Air team did quite a historic interview with Erin Pitsey from the UK, and we thought it was probably one of the most highly publicised interviews that we've done, and very topical because the issue of domestic violence is still very much on the Australian government's radar. So here we are, we're going to replay it for you today. Here it is, our interview with Erin Pitsey.
We're going to be talking with Erin Pitsey. This is an historic moment for Dads on the Air. Erin Pitsey is a world-renowned specialist on gender issues, a world-renowned commentator. She's written a number of books, including Scream Quietly or The Neighbours Will Hear You, and a very controversial book, Prone to Violence, which caused an enormous uproar when it was first published, and she was picketed by feminists and had a huge outcry against that book. She's also received a huge number of awards over the years and written a large number of articles on the issues that we so often talk about on this radio program, including Domestic Violence is Not a Gender Issue, The Planned Destruction of the Family, and most recently a very controversial article in the Daily Mail, How Feminists Tried to Destroy the Family. Welcome to the show, Erin Pitsey.
Hello.
Very good to have you on.
Thank you.
Gather you've just been to Bahrain. I wondered if you could first talk about that. You were opening a domestic violence refuge there.
Yes. What happened is several years ago, I was asked by Shirley Yateem, whose family put the money up for a refuge. Her mother-in-law, who was very well known in the Arab world, she was a very early feminist in the sense that she opened the first club for Bahraini women to meet outside their houses, which was unheard of in those days. When she died, her husband, Hussein, who's a lovely man, decided with the family that what they would like to do, with knowing of the problems in the Arab world, was to open a refuge. So 2 years later, last month, I came back from Bahrain having opened it. The Queen of Bahrain was there, and for the first time, the entire subject of domestic violence was publicly discussed and reported in all the Arab newspapers across the Arab world, because it's the first. And it's an enormously important step forward. I think the thing that consoled me from the very beginning is that because they'd never been brainwashed by the whole feminist movement, there was no attitude of hostility towards men. So I was able to say from the very beginning, when I opened the refuge in 1971, and it was the only one of its kind in the world, that I'd said that many of the women coming in were violent themselves or more violent than the men they left. And this was the beginning of this huge split that's overshadowed the movement across the world for the last 36 years.
Have you ever regretted being you're the most famous, I guess, for opening the very first battered woman's refuge in the world. Have you ever kind of wished you hadn't done it, or taken a different path?
Well, yes. I mean, obviously, I had this vision of because I came from a violent family, and both my mother and father were violent. Actually, if anything, my mother was a great deal crueler than my father. He was a bully, and we were very frightened of him, but she was the one that actually did the battering, particularly of me, because I looked like him. So I always opened the refuge with a completely open understanding of what domestic violence does to children. The tragedy of it all was at that same time in 71, the women's movement, the feminist movement, had just been imported directly from America, and women across the country leapt onto the barricades, and these were largely Marxist feminists who then said that, well, the enemy wasn't capitalism anymore, the enemy was actually men, the patriarchy. So I knew when I opened the refuge that they would come and try and hijack the whole subject, which they did, because they were enormously highly organised.
It is incredible.
What?
It is incredible here, the amount of money and just the way they dominate the entire debate, the entire public debate.
Well, you see, the trouble was, in those very early days, I was this very, very lone voice saying, hey, hang on, wait a minute, this has nothing to do with domestic violence. This is a feminist movement which is basically hijacking the subject because it's a worthy cause in their term. And also, they wanted the funding because they couldn't get funding as open feminists. But what they have managed to do is to turn it into a billion-dollar industry, which has effectively destroyed family life in the Western world and feminized the courts, the law, everything else in its wake. And the result is that there's millions of men who've been falsely accused, who've lost their children, who've been extradited from their families. And I suppose the major problem I have is, and I've worked with men's groups all over the world, whether it's Canada or America or here or Bermuda, for instance, but men do not get together and organize themselves over emotional issues.
No, they most certainly do not. They tend to crawl off under a rock or into their cave, basically.
Because in a sense, I think this is the first time in the history of the world, men have been so attacked in their emotional lives, they don't actually know how to relate to each other.
No, that's quite possibly true. You must have been an incredibly isolated voice to start off with.
I was, and very frightened a lot of the time. I mean, it got to such a ridiculous pitch that anywhere I spoke, I was picketed, and then people would scream at me while I was speaking, whether it was I was in England or America or wherever. What I'm doing at the moment, I have a blog, and if you type Erin Pitsey into Google and then type This Way to the Revolution, you can follow what I'm saying. Because what was so lonely was that if I tried to explain it to anybody, it was so complicated they would just not listen or just say, you're paranoid. But now I think there's sufficient amount of men who've suffered internationally for them to begin to realize that what I was saying was actually the truth. It broke my heart out of all of this. I opened the refuge. It wasn't supposed to be a refuge. It was supposed to be a small community center for women who were isolated with their children like I was. I was married, but my husband was a television reporter, so I didn't see him very much. A small community center where we could get together and work on the things that were necessary for women in our community, because that was my version of what I thought feminism should be about, working in harmony with men. But, of course, that was ludicrous. That isn't anything to do with what the feminist movement was about. So what happened was that when that first woman came in, Kathy, and took off her jersey and showed me her bruises, I immediately understood what she said when she said, no one will help me. But I didn't understand her in a sense as an adult. I understood the child because I was the child in Montreal standing in front of a teacher with blood running down my legs from whipping my mother had given me with an ironing cord saying, please, will you help me? And the teacher looked at me and just said, I don't blame your mother for beating you. You're such a terrible child. And I have since written a memoir called Infernal Child. You can get it on Amazon. And this is the story of what it is like to be a child in a warring family. And the thing that hurt me most is because the women's movement hijacked this entire subject and made it all about women for so many years, no one ever talked until recently about the effect it's having on children.
And the debate really still hasn't switched very much, has it?
Well, no, because it's still, you see, the women in the 71, when I started, the younger women who are now in corridors of power in England, Harriet Harman and Patricia Hewitt, they're all in the government. And so how are we ever going to get anything through? Because their argument is, and even though it's proved wrong, even though we know that within the domestic violence sphere, the violence is about equal. I'm not interested in discussions about how many men hit women or how many women hit men, because it's quite simple. If children are born into violent families, both boys and girls will be infected. Some will transcend. But I believe that boys are far more disadvantaged and destroyed by domestic violence than girls. Girls seem to be a lot more resilient.
Why do you say that?
Well, because simply by taking in, I was taking for a long time over 1,000 mothers and children a year because I had a very huge project. And I was noticing how the difference between the small boys coming in, the children coming in, and the violence, explosive violence of the boys. And although the girls were similarly affected by violence, they handled it far more differently. I don't know why it is, but, you know, what I also noticed, where the father's violent, it's an absolute tragedy. But when the mother's violent, it's catastrophic.
Do you think that perhaps the little girls have an emotional language which enables them to maybe express some of their feelings, whereas the boys maybe bottle it up and then explode? Do you think there may be something there?
I think both things. I think girls are much more likely to analyse what's happening in the family and discuss it with each other and discuss it with adults, whereas boys don't. Boys are... There is a chivalrous gene in boys. They do not discuss. They are very, very loyal, particularly to their mothers.
No matter what that mother does.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's absolutely amazing.
And those boys grow up to be members of parliament, and probably the same chivalrous gene is still there.
It's still there, yeah.
Mm.
So you've seen the development of this right the way through from the beginning.
Yeah.
I mean, could you ever have imagined way back in the 70s that we would reach the state we are in now?
Well, I suppose I had a premonition of it, because before I opened my little community centre, I had been one of the first people to help set up what I thought the women's movement was going to be about. And how naive was that? I mean, I was in that. The only experience, life experience I had was that I was born in China, in Shanghai. We were captured by the Japanese. And so in a sense, politics of that sort was in my blood, because later in 49, both my parents were sent to what was then Tianjin, back to China. They were captured by the communists and held under house arrest. And many of the people who were captured with them were tortured, and many were killed. So I had a bird's eye view of what the joys of communism were going to mean to the rest of us. So when I first went to the meetings of the Women's Liberation Movement, which was supposed to be a movement for women and about women, I realized it was nothing. It was just yet one of those many, many fronts to raise money for, in those days, the Marxist Feminist Communist Party. And I remember saying to them, quite cynically, hey, hang on a minute, if I have to call everybody comrade and meet in cells and pay you £3.10, you want me to join the Communist Party? I don't want to join a Communist Party. I want a women's movement. So eventually I got booted out. So I had an inkling of what was going to happen, because I was also aware that in England particularly, the feminist movement didn't really reach down into any part of England. It was really always a sort of very white, middle-class, educated, university-educated type women, dissatisfied with themselves and dissatisfied with their lives. And it always struck me as quite relevant that Germaine Greer, one of yours...
Yes.
We disowned her a while ago.
The American feminists both had fathers who abandoned them and wrote books about it. And, you know, that thing that the movement was based on, which is making the personal political, well, that to a large extent is what happened. Many of those leaders themselves are seriously flawed people with personality disorders.
And the personal is the political. It doesn't work both ways, does it?
Well, you can't make, actually, your own unique human experience. You cannot extrapolate that to then include everybody else. If your father, like mine, was a violent bully, it doesn't mean that every man I know is going to be a violent bully. It simply means that he was a product of his own background, which I understand. I'm now nearly 70. I know my mother was horribly abused when her mother died when she was young, and the stepmother was very violent. And so was my grandfather, Thomas Last, who was Canadian. We come from Portland in I think it's near Montreal. And a hideous history of abuse, and my father the same.
Fought, and I fought with no end to my man agony. is in distress, meet in your area every week. If you're in one custody,
it's just
in distress, meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437, or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
We're talking with Erin Pitsey. She's the author of Prone to Violence. She's on the line from the UK. What is the solution to this? What do you think of the programs that operate in a lot of domestic violence treatment programs and so on?
Well, because they're politically based, they basically miss the entire opportunity to help people come to terms with their past. I mean, the programs, the anger management courses that, as far in England, I can only speak for England, and America and Canada where I've been, basically are there to punish men better. Well, you can't do that.
Yes,
and of course, there's no recognition that women can be equally complicit in the violence, the treatment programs are useless.
And literally hundreds of millions of dollars are poured into these programs.
Absolutely.
And you define them as complete waste of money.
Well, yes, because essentially, to take somebody, let's say, in these days, a violent man, he goes into an anger management program. He is treated as though the origins of his violence are of his own volition, even though we know, and if you're interested, you should read Dr. Bruce Perry's papers. He is a neurobiologist. He works from Houston. He has a huge child development organization there, and he is one of the first ones to talk about the damage done to young children's brains, probably during pregnancy, by domestic violence. And once everybody realizes the responsibility for parents that are violent towards their children, that they actually brain damage them, if not when they're born from birth, then perhaps we have to see where it needs to to concentrate. We need to concentrate on in schools, among young people, among young parents who themselves can safely say, yes, I did come from a violent family. I know I have these tendencies. Please, can I have some help?
And if someone is asked for that help now, they get none.
Well, not any help that would... If they're a man, they're simply told, you're violent because you have a Y chromosome. That's according to the feminist theory. All men are violent because of the patriarchy, because they are men. So you're born potentially a rapist, a batterer, and a child abuser.
So even if you go, if your female partner is being physically or emotionally abusive to you as a man, when you ask for help, even though you're the victim, you're told that you have the problem because you're a man.
Yes, and you know, the tragedy for me is that we, in the end, Chiswick became a huge therapeutic community for women who are violent. And many of the refugees in those days, because they couldn't handle already violent women, would send them to Chiswick. Women who were innocent victims of their partner's violence, battered women, we would send to refugees that were just hostels, which is what most refugees are. Once I lost the refuge and everything was closed down, there was nowhere for violence-prone women to receive any treatment or even to be recognized. All women going into these refuges, which are largely feminist, are told they're victims. It doesn't matter what happens. If she murders a man, she's a victim. If she batters, abuses, and sexually abuses him, she's still a victim. And that is getting us nowhere.
And is this actually harming women themselves by encouraging them to see themselves as victims?
I think it's incredibly damaging, because to not allow someone to tell the truth about how they're feeling, that in order to stay within a refuge she has to maintain a lie, which is that she is a victim, is extremely bad for her mental health. Yes. Mm.
Yeah, it's also bad for her getting out of the place as well, for her future, the cure for the situation. I mean.
Yeah.
One of the things that I always note in reading stuff about you is just how violent or how vicious the reactions against you were from the feminist movement. Can you talk a bit about those days?
Well, I think you have to remember it was big money. This was their one chance to create this huge edifice. I mean, it's like a very large, bloated Portuguese man of war floating, you know, those great big jellyfish.
Yeah.
And because one of the things that they saw from the beginning, that they could create this whole new women's, if you like, world, which could exclude men. So all of a sudden, all the universities started all their women's studies, books, research projects, money poured in. I remember going to America in 76, I think, or 77, and doing this huge tour and just looking at this huge new world that was going to be women only. The refuges excluded men, and to this day, no men can sit on boards, no men can work in the refuges. It's a completely isolated experience. So I knew that part of the hatred that they had and the rage they had against me is that I threatened the funding.
Because they really, you were really painted as the complete devil of the peace, weren't you?
Oh, yeah. And I mean, it got very violent. Death threats, warnings. It picketed everywhere I went, screamed at, and even now, I mean, you know, I'm still considered a total. In fact, it's quite peaceful, because they, in England particularly, they just really brush me out of the whole movement. So I'm not really known for what I do. I just quietly work on my own. I write my blog. I help women and men. I work for many men. In fact, when I went to America, that's where I was living in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and I had a refuge there. I ended up in court with men far more than I ever did with women.
So, Erin, how do you see the way forward in this? We've reached this stage where this debate's entirely one-sided and dominated by politics, basically. And how do you see us moving forward from this? How do you see change?
I don't see it ever happening unless men are willing to work together. And I mean, you know, I was invited to New Zealand in 78 by the Mental Health Association of New Zealand, and I was supposed to go across to Australia to visit all the refugees. But by the time I got to New Zealand, the refugees in Australia realised what I was going to say, so I was banned from coming across and from all the refugees. So I've never even been to Australia, but certainly other countries like Canada, where I spent 6 weeks travelling that vast country talking to men's groups, I just feel this sense that until men are willing to put down their swords and cooperate with each other to do something about this, we're not going to get very much change.
They're always talking about it, but it doesn't seem to happen.
Well, because men won't... look at this. After I opened that refuge in Chiswick, I realised I needed to be a refuge for men, because I had enough violent women coming in to realise that the problem was not gender-based anyway. So I asked the GLC in those days if I could have a house for battered men. They gave me a house. It was a beautiful house in North London. The millionaire men who would put their hands in their pockets to help my women and children refused me a penny for each other. Men will not help men.
You certainly see that in this country as well, that a lot of the different groups, they're all arguing very similar things, but they do not work together well.
But don't the women's movement also have all various groups?
They do, and they have tremendous factions and falling out. But what's so interesting about women is that they will take care of each other. They will actually bury their various battles in order to get on with the movement, whereas men just don't.
Do you think it comes back to that the chivalrous gene again, possibly, that the men are out there, all these male leaders ruling the world, ruling companies, they're out there often looking after women and children, but when asked to look after men.
About looking after each other, that's the bit that really baffles me.
It's almost like it's hardwired into male biology. It seems so intractable.
And to see each other as the enemy.
I always think of them as bulls all in their separate paddocks, and they all want to get out of the paddock, but they'll be buggered if they're going to cooperate to do so.
I know, and the thing is, the losers are their children. That's the thing I can never understand. And the people who do work hard in the movements, the heartbreaking thing for them is they say, you know, yes, and once I've resolved his problem, he goes and I never see him again.
Yeah, that's
right. Whereas in the refuge, three quarters of the people who worked in the refuge were all women volunteers.
But there's some theories about that, because the way the man once he goes through the family law system, he is financially and emotionally exhausted at the end of it, and they don't have the energy to actually... There's only a very few that will actually go into groups and actually become active that way. Mm. They're destroyed emotionally and financially in every way.
Well, you know, I think one of the things men really have to look at, the 21st century men, is that and I've said this so often to men, they have got to learn not to be so emotionally dependent on the women in their lives. Mm. They really do have to.
Yes.
And they are. You know, I mean, that's one of the things. For instance, women open... If a woman girlfriend has a problem, a woman will say, come stay with me. If a man's friend has a problem, he doesn't say, come and stay with me. If his wife might... Or you ask his wife.
So come and have a drink.
Yeah, just coming. There isn't this concept that men should care for each other the way women care for everyone.
I think that there is a generational change coming through. I know I'm in my 30s, and I have a number of friends in their 20s. Increasingly, men are, you know, a man's going through a rough patch in his relationship, and he'll call his male friend and say, come round, have a cuppa, and they'll have a chat about it and give each other advice. And it is happening, I think, but it's going to take maybe generations for that to really come about full swing.
But we can't wait that long because of the children. I think you know, the other thing too, I was saying 36 years ago, is we have to understand, in these violence prone relationships, we understand addiction to alcohol. We understand addiction to drugs. We don't really understand addiction to a relationship. And once you begin to think about, which Freud said years and years ago, he said, one day all emotions will be found in chemicals of the brain. Now, those are the same chemicals of alcohol and drug addiction. We carry those chemicals in our brain, in the endorphins. Now, what will determine your choice of partner is your childhood experiences, the way your brain is actually set up to receive information. And you see perfectly, this is where it works, and it's quite easy to deal with, where a perfectly normal person, by accident, gets involved with a violence-prone person. And once they get help, they can get out without any difficulty because they're not actually addicted to that personality. They're basically fooled into thinking they were something they weren't, and then when the violence starts, they're out of there. The problem is where you find yourself in a totally addictive relationship to somebody you know is a disaster for you, but you cannot leave it alone, and you go back and back and back, and sometimes you go back till you die.
So fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child.
What do you care? It's not like you were ever there anyway.
Dads in Distress meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437 or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
We're talking with Erin Pitsey. She's one of the world's leading commentators on gender, author of the book Prone to Violence, and most famous for setting up the world's first refuge for battered women in the UK. She's on the line from the UK. there has been here a multi-million dollar domestic violence campaign over the last few months in Australia, in television advertising and newspaper advertising. You cannot these days go to a urinal in the movies without having these posters in front of you as a bloke while you're attending to nature, suggesting that if you're a violent person, contact this number.
If you have friends who are violent, contact this number.
Yeah, but what will happen when you contact the number?
Oh, the police will come around and arrest you and take you away as a violent person.
Yeah, I mean, only just recently here in England, and I do quite a lot of public speaking, are the police, because now we've got mandatory arrest. It used to be that whatever happened, the police would pick up the man. Doesn't happen so much now. They do pick up the one that they think, the other day it was a woman and she was carted off.
Right.
I mean, in fact, she was treated far gentler than if it had been the man in custody. But at least here, we're beginning to recognise that women are capable of being violent. And even though it's still saturated with men as the perpetrators, the language has become much more gender neutral because they have to.
This campaign that we've had here in Australia paints the men as perpetrators and as the women as victims completely. There is no variation on that. Do you think those sort of campaigns do more harm than good?
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely, because it's a lie apart from anything else. It's a terrible lie.
Yeah.
Mm.
You know perfectly well that when you get involved with a woman, unless you know her background and what is likely to happen, you can wake up one morning and find you're involved with a nightmare. And then there's the nightmare of trying to get out of it. Because
absolutely.
You're preaching to the converted here.
Nightmare next to her. She has all sorts of avenues for escape and immediate sympathy and immediate protection.
And support.
But just as likely it's going to be a man. And he is going to get ridiculed, laughed at. Mm. Just like my father was 6'4" and my mother was a traditional 4'9". Nightmare. No one would ever believe what my mother got up to behind the front door. My father was a diplomat, and they travelled all over the world. And they were both totally addicted to each other. Actually, I would say he was completely addicted to her, and she just very cold-bloodedly used him because he had money and influence.
Is there any evidence that these public education campaigns decrease the level of interpersonal violence in the community at all?
Well, no. I mean, obviously they don't, because basically, as long as you have this huge lie that whatever is happening in the family is not happening, because most domestic violence actually is consensual. Both parties are violent. One party may not be physically violent to the other, but in those sort of relationship addiction situations, they don't leave each other. The violence is perpetual. It needs treatment. It needs to come out of the courts where it shouldn't be treated into mental health issues.
So
if
what?
You think, sorry.
Oh, too right. Sorry. What is the research showing then now in this whole debate?
The whole debate is showing that the figures for domestic violence behind the front door, roughly equal. Which is what I would expect. Back to the whole concept, if children are exposed to violent parents, both boys and girls are affected. So you would expect to see virtually equal figures anyway, wouldn't you?
Mm-hmm. Aaron, your book, Prone to Violence, which was thoroughly boycotted and totally censored by the feminists, what was so objectionable to them?
It's a whole record, and you can find... I put it up online, so you can read it online.
Yes.
The whole thing was because it was a discussion and a description of the work I did within the refuge to help women who were already violent and seeking help. It was the work I did with children. There's a whole chapter on children who kill. It was about women who were already violent, who'd been battered and sexually abused as children, about the prostitutes that came into the refuge, how they too had all... it caused havoc because it was even-handed.
What was the work? What was your approach with those women? How did you help them, and how is it different to the way that the system now apparently helps women?
Anybody coming to me who isn't capable of making warm, loving relationships needs to actually spend that time going back into the very early memories of when they were first abused, abandoned, and betrayed themselves. And then with understanding and help, work their way through. So in a sense, they can mend themselves. See, we don't give anybody a second chance. They can come through small mini concentration camps of childhoods. And anything they do thereafter, they're punished for.
So
it shouldn't be like that.
If a child is in a domestic violence situation, or someone that listening to this program is a perpetrator or a victim, what do you say to those people? What should they just get out, or what?
Your violence, you can transcend it. I had to. Lots of people do. I mean, not everyone who's come from a violent home goes on to repeat the patterns. We don't even look at that. Because we see this, because we've always seen domestic violence as a huge political issue, we've never looked at it the way it should be looked at. And you know, what you need to do if you're listening and you are suffering and you are aware that you are making violent relationships is you need to go back and work on yourself. Everybody has to try. There's no such thing as perfect parents, you know. We all have to actually, you know, transcend our own childhoods, look at what our parents gave us that was valuable and good, and hold on to that, and throw away the stuff that wasn't. And then make that vow that whatever happens in your life, you will not repeat those patterns on your own children.
And so when you take people into these refuges, what do you do for them?
What happens is, the refuge was a relearning program, if you like, a reparenting program. Chiswick was like a great big unruly family. Mike Dunn, who was a rugger player and ex-priest, he was one of the therapists, and he was a sort of father figure. Phil Pepper was a house mother. She was in her 70s, and she was a grandmother figure. I was the mother figure, and there were loads of aunts and uncles around, and it was a huge project. You came in with your children. There you could be yourself. Yes, if you were violent. Yes, if you had alcohol problems. All of it. You were welcome, and you were loved. And in a way, I mean, I always felt, possibly, in a sense, I could never rehabilitate my own mother, and she died when I was 17 of cancer. But I did recognize that it is possible to rehabilitate if people want to be helped, and people did want to be helped. That was the thing. So many of the women would just say, I'm so glad I can tell you what happens.
Of course, one of the problems is today that the current system eliminates the father, who, like the mother, they both want to protect their children. But when the father is eliminated from being able to help the children, that's where part of the problem is, isn't it? Because there's only one parent, and often because of gender, the children are left with the most dysfunctional of their parents.
Yes, I mean, that's the tragedy. And because of in a sense, in the next 50 years, we're going to look back, and the last, these last years from 71 onwards will be seen as the dark ages for the family in the Western world.
Absolutely.
It really will. And you know, I was at those huge collectives when the feminist movement were at its height in England, when it was at its most vociferous, and the launching of this destruction of the family. The family was not a safe place for women and children. The family had to be restructured, and the family had to call itself women and children were the family unit. Men, women and children were no longer acceptable. Men had to be disenfranchised from family life.
So you see yourself, the feminist movement has done, what, more harm than good, or...?
I think it's one of the most evil movements of this last century.
And yet you yourself are clearly highly intelligent and very successful woman.
I live in a bed sit. That's my pension, because I've been bankrupted so often by this. So I'm highly intelligent, but I'm not successful, no.
Are you generalising by saying that? Because surely that it must be just the radical feminists who are like that. You're saying that the feminist movement as a whole...
Is evil. Yeah, because the entire concept is evil.
Right.
Any movement that sets out to hate...
Yes.
As the feminist movement does. I mean, even down to the woman in the street who will say, I'm a feminist, what does she actually mean? She means she's derogatory about men.
But doesn't it mean, like, feminist, that she's basically... you know, that they're pushing the women's cause. Not, I mean, not so much denigrating men, but elevating women. I mean, that's where.
But nobody needs to do that. I mean, you know, all of us who have children, who have brothers and uncles, and you know, women hold up half the sky, but men hold up the other half.
So how have you managed personally to survive the level of vitriol that you've faced and to go on as you've done?
Faith, the love of God, really. I'm a lover of God in all his aspects. I'm not comfortable with organized religions, but I absolutely, passionately believe that I am loved and we are all loved. And I accepted very early on when I realized, and I'd actually come face to face with this movement, and I was thrown out. I was banned from all the collectives. I realized what I was taking on, and I knew it was going to be hard, and I knew it was going to be lonely, and it still is.
We're running out of time now. Can you just sum up for us what you've... I don't know how you could do it, but if you could sum up your experiences over time and what you would like to pass on.
I think sometime in most people's lives, they're faced with something they know that is evil, and they have a choice. You can either decide that it is your job to overcome this and to fight it through, or you can run away. And I chose to stand up and fight it. And what I feel now passionately when I'm talking to men is there has to be a consciousness raising among men that they are responsible for each other. There has to be a laying down of the swords. You know, and the trouble is so many men are wounded warriors, and they have to heal themselves before they go into battle. And the future for actually overthrowing this dreadful movement has to be in men's hands. They have to get together to fight for the sake of their children.
We've been talking with Erin Pitsey. She's one of the world's leading commentators on gender and the author of a number of books, including Prone to Violence, Scream Quietly or the Neighbours Will Hear You, and a number of other articles, including Domestic Violence is Not a Gender Issue. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Okay.
No, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you.
See my sweet daughter, we've been apart now for almost a year. I can still see the smile that shows up a dimple. The thought of her laughter brings forth a tear. As I sit on the bank of this quiet little stream that carries her name, I remember my dream. She was playing in the water, I was trying to warn her. Sadly, she couldn't hear my scream. Oh, Brooke, my beautiful Brooke, why did you leave me like that? Oh, Brooke, my beautiful Brooke, you're my daughter, so I'll never forget. When she stayed at my house, she learned how to swim and ride a pushback. Such mountains we climbed. We saw lots of shows and dressed up the dog. Walked to the river, rocks with green slime. This cute little daughter with blonde ponytail, big round blue eyes, soft skin that is pale. It's so long since I've seen her, oh, how I'd miss her. Once back together, we'll then tell a tale. My beautiful Brooke, why did you leave me like that? Oh Brooke, my beautiful Brooke, you're my daughter.
brook. Why did you leave me like that? Oh, brook, my beautiful brook. You're my daughter, so I'll never forget.
They grow so fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child. Dad's in Distress. 1-300-853-437.
We're back with Dad's on the Air.
Welcome back to Dad's on the Air. Alec Baldwin took a lot of heat after an angry voicemail to his daughter was leaked back in 2007. In his recently released book about parental alienation called A Promise to Ourselves, he confides that he was suicidal after the voicemail incident. Mark Sutton from Liberal Arts Radio in the US talked recently with Susan Block, a family law attorney and former administrative judge of the family court, about the Baldwin case, family law problems in general, and new solutions that are being implemented in the US state of Missouri.
Professional life is soaring, but for the past several years, his personal life has been a much darker story.
The book was contracted with the publisher a year before my episode with the voicemail.
I want to tell you something, okay? And I want to leave a message for you right now. Because again, it's 10:30 here in New York on Wednesday. And once again, I've made an ass of myself trying to get you a phone to call you at a specific time. When the time comes for me to make the phone call, I stop whatever I'm doing, and I go and I make that phone call.
The book was initially a critique of the family law system, the judges and the lawyers and the family therapists that are part of that system.
Yeah.
And in parental alienation, a custodial spouse typically, and it's most often a woman in our society, they give custodial...
Custodial spouse is the person who has the...
The person has primary custody of the child. Mm-hmm. They turn the child against the other parent. The other side, whether it was at the behest of my ex-wife or it was something that was cooked up by her lawyers, they interfered with and attempted to take away as much of that visitation as they possibly could. Mm-hmm. The divorced parent, the alienated parent in particular, who is under the microscope, is asked to parent a child in a way that the judge and the lawyers in the room and the bailiffs and the court stenographers, none of them parent their child that way. And often in alienation cases, parenting itself is viewed as abusive. Like if I was married to you and we had a child, we're at the house and I say to my child, I'm going to take your cell phone, I'm going to take your computer, I want you to do your homework. I'm very firm and I'm very stern with my child. And the mother will look at the child and say, do what your father tells you. Mm-hmm. That same woman in that dynamic, in the parental alienation dynamic, goes into court and she uses that same behavior and says the father is abusive to the child. The people from typically feminist groups who oppose parental alienation syndrome and view it as an excuse that abusers use to dodge responsibility in courtrooms, I want to say to them that the groups that I work with, we agree with them on nearly everything.
Right.
Men who abuse their children, men who abuse their wives, that should be, and it's proven, that should be determinative of child custody. But what do you do? Like when I read all the writing of these organizations, they never once mention what becomes of the woman who lies about those things in order to alienate the child from the father.
Okay, that of course was Alec Baldwin. His book is called A Promise to Ourselves, and that was from his appearance on The View. And, you know, we've all heard that voicemail, and you heard a little of it in that segment there, that is pretty scary, and I think Alec Baldwin was pretty much universally hated when that voicemail came out. However, when you start to hear these stories, like from Angelo's film, we heard a lot of these stories about men, you know, who go to drastic measures to try to see their kids and are prevented at every turn, and then they get extremely frustrated. At least I think we can have a little understanding for Alec Baldwin's situation. And so to get a little more insight on this, we have a former family court judge, current family court lawyer, and we really want to thank her for coming in because we've been hearing a lot of trash talking about the family court system on today's show. So this is Susan Block. She is a family court lawyer from St. Louis, Missouri. Susan, thanks for speaking with us and shedding some light on this.
Thank you for asking me.
Let's first of all start out with Alec Baldwin's accusation in his book. He says, you know, right in the introduction to his book, He talks about the, how there are injustices that are endemic to the family law system in our society. Is there a real problem with the system, or is this just an isolated case?
No, I think in general there is a problem with the family court system in that we have gone from being a society that was very traditionally matriarchal in terms of raising the children to a society that is quite egalitarian in terms of both parents wanting to be involved in raising the children, and I believe in society believing in general that that is good for a child. So when that happens, the family court system has evolved and I think is sort of trying to catch up with life.
I want to talk right now about parental alienation or parental alienation syndrome, whether you believe it's a syndrome or not. Is this something that you saw in the court, and is this something you could try to prevent or you could try to stop it?
I think it's a tremendously difficult task to prevent one parent from trying to alienate the children from another parent. But what we find is, at least this is the solution that the judges normally use. I'm not saying it's perfect, but this mm-hmm. is the theory. The theory is if a child is exposed to both parents for similar amounts of time, that the child will more or less form his or her own opinion about the value of that parent. And his or her opinion will in general prevail over what the other parent is telling them.
Well, do you think it's a good idea to have court-ordered counseling for parents so that they do not pit each other against the child so that they're really playing for the same team?
There are a lot of issues to consider. The first issue is timing. Mm-hmm. When people are first getting divorced, generally speaking, one person is on one timeline and another person is on the other timeline. One person has been thinking of it for a very long time, and the other person, whether or not we think they should be surprised, is actually surprised. So to put those two people in a room together with their own individual emotions and think that they could rise above that and have a discussion that would end up with the result being beneficial to the child is pretty unrealistic.
But don't you think that would be a better idea than what seems to happen a lot currently, where it's each person hires a lawyer and spends a lot of money with the lawyers, if they could have some sort of mediation and prevent that, they could put that money away for college, for the kid, or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think ideally mediation is an excellent idea. It just doesn't work for people who are individually, emotionally on different planes. Let me just say this. There mm-hmm. is something new in Missouri that hasn't, you know, caught on like wildfire, but it's a very interesting concept called collaborative law.
Okay.
Each party hires an attorney, and then the four work as a team in problem solving. In other words, it's not, you know, fault finding. It's not blame finding, although there may be fault and there may be blame, but it's really to get the divorce resolved. And this certainly includes child custody. And the deal is, if they're unable to resolve it as a team, they have to go out and get two hired guns. So their motivation is pretty strong if they decide to do this, to come up with a decision together, because they can't use those same people if they're going to, you know, get into the trial mode. You know, I think the point, you know, that I wouldn't want to be lost is that there is a great value to a child being exposed substantially and being cared for substantially by both parents.
Okay.
Even if one parent is, I would say, more skillful or more artful or more emotionally available, I do think that in general, young people growing up fare better with a real experience with a real parent.
All right, Susan, thank you so much for talking with us today. We're going to wrap it up on that note.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Susan Block from St. Louis, Missouri. She is a former family court judge, and she's currently in practice. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Mark.
Many thanks once again to Mark Sutton from Liberal Arts Radio in the US for allowing us to use his material on Dads on the Air today. The website is liberalartsradio.com. Welcome back to Dad's on the Air. There's a story out from the UK. There's been a bit of new research coming out of the University of Newcastle, which actually shows that there's a clear link between substantial father involvement and higher child IQ, which is very interesting. Shows that for dads that are still involved with their families, that their intimate involvement with their children is going to have an impact on the children's IQ. And also for separated dads, that what a devastating impact separating fathers from their children can have in terms of their future well-being. I'll read you this article. This is from the Fatherhood Institute website in the UK. It says that New research by Daniel Nettle at the University of Newcastle shows a clear link between substantial father involvement and higher child IQ. Now, it says this is not the first time this link has been shown. However, what it found was that where fathers were highly involved, infants aged 12 months and 3 years recorded higher IQs. And it also found that the IQ link still held at ages 7 and also at ages at age 11. So all through when a child grows up, it's consistent that if a father is involved intimately with that child, that it will have higher IQs.
Well, that would appear, that would seem to back up the idea that the mother is basically responsible for the child's physical well-being and the development of its body, whereas the father is more responsible for the development of the child's mind.
Absolutely. And this is, the study says that specifically, because what it says is that the researchers actually controlled for mother's involvement. So that it's, the father's effect is independent of the mother's effect. So regardless of how involved the mother was, this father involvement still held through, held true in terms of IQ. So that backs up what you're saying there, Ian. Absolutely. Now the study also found that, when dads living in two-parent families spend very little time engaging with their children, the impact on their IQs is just as low as if the fathers were absent. So if a father's at home but not engaged with the kids, basically that's the same as the father not being there at all. So it's not just enough for the dad to be at home, but he actually needs to be reading to his child and, you know, and actively involved with
on the job. Yep.
On
hands
the job.
On
absolutely. Being a hands on dad. Not just being the breadwinner who, you know, supports his child financially and puts the roof over their head, but he has to be in there doing the parenting as well.
Well, obviously, and contributing to the child's ideas, talking to the child, helping the child form its opinions and attitudes, which will probably be the basis of its opinions and attitudes maybe for its whole life.
Absolutely. And the implications here are that docs and child protective services all around the world that seem to have this policy that, you know, dads are dangerous and they should be, they should be somehow kept away from children. The opposite's actually true. They should be supporting, in the case of separation, they should be supporting a relationship between the dad and the child. And this actually, is going to be very good for the child.
Yeah, it's scientifically based rather than the feminist argument that basically men are dangerous brutes and should be kept away from women and children at all costs, except for the initial coupling, which enables the women to have the children.
That's it.
Which is, you know, we know here, I mean, we look at the statistics and we know the reality of the situation. I mean, you cannot underestimate the value of a father in a child's life. And it goes further than that, because I would even go as far as to say that the greatest resource of any society is its men. You know, it's the men who go out and you know, hold back the storm. It's the men who go out and stop the invading forces. You know, it's the men who build the rockets that fly to the moon. I mean, like I said in the Daddy Split Guide, who was the first woman on the moon?
Well, look, I would disagree there. I think women play an equally important role in terms of the role they play. But I think that it's men's role that's been undervalued by 30 years of politics and ideology that says that men are lazy, that men are violent, that men are useless, when in fact the opposite's true, that both men and women are absolutely essential, absolutely should be respected for the roles, the different roles, or the often different roles that they play.
Well, that's absolutely true. We know that here. I think that just about wraps it up for today. You can listen to this program on www.dadsontheair.net. It should be up sometime this afternoon or tomorrow morning, and I hope you enjoyed today's program.
We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're dead.